Hello, my name is Raj Mehta, and welcome to Richard Lehman Discusses EBM. How are you today, Richard?
I'm full of the joys of spring, thanks, Raj. It's finally arriving in England. And I believe that today we're going to talk a little bit more about numbers needed to treat, or NNT.
Yes, NNT is a really important subject that comes up a lot in EBM. But those of you who are not as familiar with statistics may be surprised to learn that this is an entirely made-up thing from the 90s, from the EBM movement, that it doesn't really exist in biostatistics or really anywhere outside medicine. So I think it's worth exploring a little bit about how NNT came about, some of the use of it, but also some of the limitations and criticisms that it has faced.
Yeah, I mean, we're doing this after a podcast on a new decision aid on GP evidence devised by Julian Treadwell, which was in many ways his reaction to the insufficiency of NNT on its own as an explanatory tool for decision makers. He wasn't thinking about patients so much as decision making. So perhaps when we start, we can think about the kind of decision makers who actually end up determining what people get as treatments. I think the context is all important here. We've got drug regulation, which is the step towards actually letting a treatment loose on the public. And for drugs, this is a well-known process with well-known drawbacks. For surgery and for devices, it tends to be much more a process whereby things get adopted through fashion or through hearsay. And so we've already got a kind of split in the world of evidence-based medicine there. And then there are complex interventions, which are often impossible to understand from the literature about them. And this is something that Paul Glasziou in particular has pointed out. That we bundle care packages together, we say that they have such and such an effect on the population. But in fact, we're none the wiser as to how to adopt them in our own locality or practice. Anyway, so drug regulation is the first one. The second is basically the area of health policy and public health. The two go together. Health policy is decided partly by the legislatures, which determine the treatments we can get. For instance, you have this dilemma in the US of individual states deciding whether you can have a termination for rape or even get ready access to treatment for ectopic pregnancy. So the legislature plays a big part in this, and of course at state level. And in the National Health Service in England, we have a legislature which really has oversight over everything that is allowed to be done to patients in our country. So the public health aspect is often equated with prevention and control of disease. And that, for that, you have a completely different concept of the number needed to treat from if you're treating individual patients. And I'm mentioning this because Raj and I are treaters of individual patients. That's what our main job is. So I think in US primary care, there's a fair amount of preventive work done as well. And so is such is the case in the UK and most developed health systems, where we're trying to persuade patients who are currently well that they need preventive treatment for conditions that they're totally unaware of, like high blood pressure or high lipid levels. So we do get into the public health era there, but a lot of the time we're dealing with acute illness, and that their NNTs have a different role. And again, We have chronic conditions and symptomatic conditions. The two aren't necessarily the same thing, though they often are. And there again, the NNT needs interpreting differently. So I'm laying out this whole stall because I think these are concepts that we ought to cover as we talk, and we can easily get sidetracked. Yes, Raj.
So this is a fantastic way to get started. So I'll begin first by describing what the NNT is, and I want to recap some of the points you've made. So NNT stands for number needed to treat, and the goal of this is to help us get a sense of communicating the magnitude of an effect from an intervention, typically in healthcare-related areas. And it's meant to measure both benefits and harms and help communicate that to patients or whomever. You brought up a great point, which is this is used in context. And so there's a huge difference between the three major communicators of effectiveness of any intervention. One are regulators, whether they're dealing with drugs, devices, surgeries, and so on. The second one is on a health policy level, whether we're discussing public health, legislature activities, or related calculations. And the third, which is what I think you and I are going to focus mostly on, is more with the care of individual patients and then helping with individual patient decision making. And that's, I think, where EBM tends to focus itself mostly, but this concept has taken on life and is often used elsewhere. And in different contexts, the pros and cons and the criticisms will vary as well.
Yeah. That's a good summary of the two great length there. You were going to start with an example which I would class as public health, and that is giving statins to the at-risk population. Very few people are given statins because they're symptomatic for everything. They may have an event, but they're not aware that their lipid levels are high, except in as much as the events will occur as a result of that, but also as a result of all sorts of other factors. And so we immediately have a kind of mix of understandings about this. You know, are we giving statins to lower lipids, particularly, low-density lipoprotein cholesterol, or are we giving them to lower cardiovascular risk generally? And do the NNTs vary, and do they vary according to particular patient classes and so on? Anyway, I'm anticipating the points you were going to bring up here.
No, this is great.
So we can start with statins. The only problem with starting with statins is you usually end up with statins because it goes on forever and ever, and everybody in the audience has their own particular view as to what we're trying to do. But there are only two of us, so perhaps we'll shut up after about 10 minutes. Okay.
Perhaps we can be succinct. I'll start with actually another one, which is pneumonia, because when we think of NNT, it's describing the magnitude of benefit. And there's many ways of describing this. So when we're communicating with patients, the benefit of this is just explaining to them how large it is. And if I'm giving antibiotics to someone with bacterial pneumonia, I would expect for each patient I give antibiotics to, they would benefit. And so my number needed to treat might be one, very, very high magnitude benefit, very good. And in acute care conditions, similar to pneumonia, it works very well because you have full resolution and it's kind of a binary thing. You either have the pneumonia or you don't. When we get to things which are more chronic disease, it's trickier, and statins offer a good example on the limitations of using NNT to describe magnitudes of effect. The first thing that's important to note is that when we use NNT, we kind of lose our frame of reference for time. If I'm dealing with an acute condition like a pneumonia, it's easy because it's going to get to resolution. But when I'm trying to calculate an NNT of a statin, there's a time frame. Is the NNT based on a study that was for 3 years, 5 years, 10 years? And it will change. The NNT I get for taking a statin for 3 years is different from 10 years, which is different from lifelong use of a statin. So that's one important thing to note. The other issue to consider here with NNTs is that it ignores baseline risk. So again, for an acute condition, that doesn't matter. You have a pneumonia, once I've made that diagnosis, I don't really care baseline status. I'm going to give you the antibiotic. I expect it to work if my diagnosis is correct. But for something like statins, if someone who's very high risk has previous heart attack or strokes, the NNT might be of greater benefit. Maybe it's 1 in 25, where someone who has no previous risk, now we're getting to population health, we're trying to do primary prevention, and that benefit gets vanishingly smaller and smaller, maybe 1 in 250, maybe 1 in 1,000. It will depend. And so you can't just really have one NNT that's applicable to everyone, because it will change depending on their baseline risk. And when we're communicating this information using visual calculators, we'll often present an NNT, which is kind of like this average of a group, but it may not be tailored for the individual in front of us. And then the last thing I'll note is the NNT is kind of gives us a point estimate. So we might say 1 in 500, but the reality is most medicine works in uncertainty. And when we have an effect, we usually have a confidence interval from studies and ranges. And the NNT just gives us the one number, but we rarely say, well, the NNT is 30, but actually the confidence interval is from 18 to 50. So there's a bit of a range uncertainty that kind of gets lost.
Yeah, that's a very good outline of the dilemma we have with using a single form of communication. And I'm going to come back to the point later on that the NNT is only as good as its usefulness in truly communicating in real life situations. If it's just something that we argue about as yet another statistical presentation of data, then clinicians are rightly not interested. They're only interested in how it aids their understanding and their communication with patients and the effectiveness of the treatments that they give to their patients. So perhaps we should just roll back slightly and explain how the NNT is derived. Do you want to do that, Raj? What it resembles mathematically?
Yes. Yeah, so in the briefest sense, when we have interventions, we assume interventions have a relative benefit. Perhaps I give a statin and it reduces my risk of a heart attack on a relative basis by 30%. Then we have to convert that relative benefit to an absolute benefit. So if my risk of a heart attack was 10 in 1,000, and I say that's down by 30%, then from 10 in 1,000, it's going to go down to 7 in 1,000. And so I've reduced the number of heart attacks I'm going to have by 3 in 1,000. And that's my absolute benefit. And what the number needed to treat does is it takes the inverse of that, it divides that by 1, and it gives me how many patients I'd have to treat to benefit one person. So if I did 3 over 1,000, that would probably give me an NNT of about 333. So I'd have to roughly treat about 300 patients in that scenario before I had one person benefited and prevented them from having the event.
And as you say, that depends on the time scale involved. If you want to reduce the total level of cardiovascular risk in a population, then you would have to know what that risk reduction would amount to over a total lifetime of taking statins. That's why statins become a problematic example, because NNTs really don't allow us to have that debate very effectively. Talking in terms of 1 in 300 and so on makes no sense unless you do an individual calculation of your patient risk and try and estimate that over a lifetime, which no trial has yet managed, because statins have only been around for less than the human life expectancy. So that brings us on to a concept which came on early, actually. Dave Sackett was talking about it in the 1990s, and that's the patient's expected event rate. That's what it was known as that time. So we're talking about 25 years of thought on this matter. Patients' expected event rates are the way that we try to sell our long-term interventions to patients. But we often don't do that very explicitly, and we probably won't use NNTs for that, I would argue. And that applies equally to treatment for high blood pressure. Where it gets a little more complicated, because you could say that's agent specific, and you could wonder if you should really factor in all the other cardiovascular risk factors as well, or simply treat the blood pressure down to a certain level. And these debates carry on quite apart from this number that we've decided is needed to treat to achieve one outcome. And of course, then there's the outcome you're trying to treat or to prevent. If you're treating stroke, are you trying to if you're treating high blood pressure, you're trying to prevent stroke, are you trying to prevent kidney failure, or trying to prevent heart failure? All these things are going to have different NNTs according to both the patient's intrinsic risk and the outcome that matters to them most. So we're beginning to see that NNT, although mathematically is very simple and seems quite a nice intuitive thing, isn't necessarily so for all kinds of prevention or intervention.
There's another challenge here, and this is not necessarily just NNT, but how we think about events in medicine, which is we become very focused on event rates, and we forget that this is actually a two-dimensional problem where, along with the event, you actually have your survival game or your time change or your quality of outcome. So if I'm giving a stent, I can count how many heart attacks I've had, or I can count how much extra years of life I've gained. So that would be my life years gain in survival. Or if I'm giving someone Tylenol for a headache, rather than counting the number of headaches I've reduced, I can count how much time did it take? On average, did everyone have their headache reduced by an hour or 2 hours or so on? And so event rates are important, but the flip side of this is outcomes always have an element of a gain or a loss that's also important to communicate that can be informative for patients and the decisions they're making.
Yeah, you also said that NNT calculates harm. I think NNH is the word, is the expression for harms, and the two obviously are hand in hand when we decide on treatments. The NNT itself doesn't really incorporate a measure of harm. We incorporate that separately. Mm-hmm. And just to complicate matters, and this is purely an aside, someone's just come up with TNT, which is the time that it takes in order to treat the population in a particular way. And a lot of our, and this is a big issue for medical staffing, because we're getting totally overloaded with guideline-driven interventions for people. And what is the opportunity cost for those? But anyway, that's completely aside from the NNT, but maybe something we'll come back to at some point. Have we done with statins? If we have, we've done awfully well.
I think so.
Would you like to think about any other aspect of using NNT?
Yes, I think the headache example is a good one. And this is one I actually got from Steve Sen, who's a statistician I've never met, but I love following on Twitter. And he had this example with headaches, where he showed that if you use NNT incorrectly, you can come up with the wrong idea of how medications work. And the thought experiment kind of works like this. Let's say you have 100 patients and they all have headaches of varying lengths. Some patients maybe have headaches for 5-6 hours, some maybe have it for an hour. And we give them an analgesic, Tylenol or paracetamol, I think you have there in the UK. And let's say on average, it reduces people's headaches by about 60 minutes. So patients who had a 2-hour headache, maybe it's down 1 hour. Patients who had a 4-hour headache, now it resolves in 3 hours and so on. So the average benefit for the average patient might be an hour or so of less headaches. And we might all think, well, that's quite a useful outcome. But if we change our outcome measurement and we say, okay, we think any headache that's resolved in under 2 hours is a successful event. And if your headache persists more than 2 hours, you're unsuccessful. Well, then you can have patients who have had a headache for 6 hours reduced to 4 hours. They don't meet that 2-hour threshold. And we say, oh, well, that medicine didn't benefit them. whereas the patients who got to the 2-hour threshold will say it did benefit them. And then we can kind of get into this myth that, oh, some people responded to the Tylenol, maybe 60 out of 100, and 40 of the 100 didn't respond to the Tylenol because they didn't meet that threshold cutoff. And we kind of get this myth that some patients aren't responding to the treatment, even though everyone is getting maybe some average benefit. And so this happens sometimes when we kind of dichotomize continuous outcomes or average results. And we just have to be careful because NNT works very well for binary outcomes. Did someone die? They didn't die. Did they have a heart attack? They didn't have a heart attack. But when we get to qualitative things, when we get to chronic things, things with more nuance, and we're creating these artificial thresholds to count events, we can sometimes come up with this myth that some people are responding and others aren't, when in reality, there may be an average benefit that everyone experiences. That benefit just may or may not be clinically relevant.
Yeah, I think you've covered the point beautifully that I haven't heard covered properly very often, actually. And there's a Cochrane pain review which came to the conclusion that Tylenol or paracetamol or minocin, they're all the same thing, didn't work if it didn't have a useful effect on headaches. Now, most of us have had headaches to varying degrees, and as you say, I mean, they can vary from absolute corkers that last for a day or something that you get and you think, oh God, I've got a meeting on, I'll have to take something for this. And it probably doesn't matter what you take. There's a huge placebo effect in headache. And, you know, if acetaminophen works as a harmless placebo for a lot of people, then probably all the better. But because at least they're doing something and then they forget their headache. But if we're looking at it from a scientific point of view, all those points that you raise are valid, particularly the duration problem and the gradation problem, the fact that headache may be alleviated without going away. And how do you measure that alleviation? You've got pain scales, Likert scales, and so on. But they're really in real life. They're pretty useless. Nobody uses them in real life, only in research. So you have to factor in all these things. When you make that decision, you always make it for yourself, don't you? Nobody actually goes, sees the doctor, I've got a headache, shall I take Tylenol? What's he going to say? What's she going to say? She'll say, well, if that doesn't work, you can try ibuprofen or whatever. So a lot of these NNT type arguments can become a little bit removed from real life. I think probably where they do get involved in real life, it's when it's a choice between different treatments.
Yes.
And then it becomes an acute or perhaps a seemingly acute matter of interest whether one treatment has a better NNT than another.
Yes.
But so prioritization of treatments is, in my view, the main utility of NNTs in real life. That and getting the doctor and the patient into the right ballpark. So one question I ask audiences sometimes is, what is the NNT for ACE inhibitors to prevent death or hospital admission in 5 years? How many patients do you need to treat with an ACE inhibitor who have systolic heart failure to prevent one death or admission in 5 years? And the answer is commonly 3 from the audience. And from the trials, it's about 20. So there's
I'm glad you just told the answer. You didn't quiz me, Richard, because I would have missed that one.
Well, exactly. And most people would, unless they've read the literature. Now, in a way, this is an artificial problem because it means essentially that in the days of the original trials, the typical systolic heart failure patient you would have to treat 20 or more typical patients to get any effect. What we actually do nowadays, I hope, is combine that treatment with several others. We've talked about this actually in a separate episode. And then the NNT becomes fairly useless because you can't summate them really. But there isn't an alternative statistic other than the actual raw estimated odds ratio to talk about. And I'm very glad that Julian Treadwell has done a lot of work on this for his website, because I found this very hard to do even in my mind, let alone explain to patients. So we'll have him on to talk about that. But for the time being, I'm just raising this issue that it gets doctors into the right ballpark in their thinking, gets patients into the right ballpark in their thinking, and allows an informed discussion. And then, as I said before, as far as the evidence goes, and the evidence is often completely inadequate, we compare one treatment with another according to the trials that are done.
Richard, I have to agree with you completely, because we have offered a lot of criticisms of the use of NNT, but I think there's also robust defense to be made. And it's not one that we'll be discussing in the annals of journal articles and things like that, but it's just a very practical reality of how physicians work, which is that the biggest challenges we have is that we do a lot of treatments and we're not immediately aware of what are the relative effect sizes. How much is treatment A better compared to treatment B? And we need to know that when we're prioritizing options, both benefits and harms, and we need to be able to communicate that to patients so patients can make those decisions. And so the real value of the NNT is not that we're giving someone a perfect prediction score of what their individual risk is that we're offering a comparison that, hey, this treatment is this much relatively better than the other one, and we're kind of getting people in the ballpark. And the reality is that without something like the NNT, a lot of people would have nothing. They just assume everything was equally effective or equally ineffective. Similarly, one of the biggest problems we have in medicine, and this is part of the reason the EBN movement even started, is that we as physicians oftentimes are wrong and overestimate the benefit we think we're going to have. I mean, our clinical experience and our observations of treatment often lead us to think drugs, surgeries, devices are more effective than they really are. And so when we look at the literature, it kind of forces us to recalibrate exactly how much benefit there is and harms. And there's just so much data out there, it's hard to keep all of it straight, but having a simple table of NNT kind of helps us recalibrate the ballpark of what is the benefit. So yes, I'm going to give an ACE inhibitor for heart failure, and I know that helps, but where is the magnitude of that? And my antibiotics is NNT of one, and I might think, oh, the ACE is like a 3 or 4, but it's really a 20. So I should still do it, and it's still important, but it helps me recognize that the magnitude here is still small relative to other interventions, and there's still a lot more that we need to be doing for heart failure. We can't just rely on this maybe being magical and taking care of all of it.
Yeah, I think we probably have come to the end of our time already. It's been an interesting discussion. We could go on, but I think we perhaps should leave it there, because I think we need to come back to this. How do we present absolute risk reductions to patients and fit it in with their particular situation? And this is going to vary a lot according to the definition of the condition as well, and our understanding of their circumstances. And that's what we're for. Our human brains are fantastically good at weighing up options dealing with several uncertainties at once. As soon as we get down to put that into mathematical form, it tends to get way beyond us, actually, except for maybe a few like you. You know, I'm all for working with intuition, for understanding what actually works on the ground, for adapting things into several formats that actually inform different sorts of people in different sorts of ways. on that note, perhaps we'll end today's podcast. Anything else that you'd like to bring up, Raj?
I'll give my takeaways and I'll let you have an opportunity to do yours before we wrap up. So one thing I've learned from you here, Richard, is not to just think of NNT in the abstract sense, but wonder how is this going to aid my communication with my patient or aid me in kind of comparing what's happening. And in that context, I think NNT can be useful, and also to keep in mind the limitations of NNT, that frequently it's not including things like the time frame for chronic diseases, that it's oftentimes not taking considered baseline risk. It's kind of just ballparking. It doesn't include the uncertainty of confidence intervals. So that's something we can often include. And just to be careful, because NNTs, you know, think of a single outcome, it loses a lot of nuance, complexity, things that are not binary outcomes. It doesn't think of things in terms of time or survival gains, which can also be very important for patients and for communicating.
Yeah, well, you've said it all there, and I said my bit before you did. So I
okay then, Richard.
Audience, if they're still listening, have certainly had the points rammed home to them, and I hope they enjoyed our podcast.
Thanks,
certainly
Richard.
Did. Thank you.